I next met with Dr. Leisha Sequest, who chaired one of the major oral lung cancer sessions at the recent ASCO meeting. And to begin our conversation, Dr. Sequest provided an overview of what happened in Chicago in terms of lung cancer.
I think there were a couple of take-home messages from the ASCO conference this year. One of the biggest was this message about targeted therapy for personalized medicine in lung cancer. And we've been hearing a lot for several years about the EGFR story, and that was a big theme of last year's ASCO, the IPASS. Well, now it's kind of a parallel story emerging with ALK, ALK. ALK is a translocation mutation that happens in a subset of lung cancer patients. And there was an exciting study presented at the plenary session at ASCO this year, which was actually a phase one study that got expanded and expanded. More and more patients with this particular mutation went on the study. And they looked at a drug which was called PFO234-1066, but now has a name, crizotinib. And crizotinib is an oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and it blocks specifically the ALK receptor. And analogous to EGFR mutation patients and Tarceva, it looks like crizotinib works very well in patients that have this ALK translocation. So I think that was by far the most exciting thing in lung cancer, was to see how now it's not just a one-line story. It really, I think, is a paradigm that's going to be repeated again and again in lung cancer.
Just to go back through that a little bit more, what do they see in terms of side effects? Do they see TKI-type things?
Well, the side effects were very mild, especially when you can compare it to something like chemotherapy. But it is distinct from the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we've all become more familiar using. It doesn't cause a lot of diarrhea. It doesn't really cause much rash at all. Some of the main side effects that this drug, crizotinib, is associated with are lower extremity edema, some vision changes, which are temporary and drug-related. There were some LFT abnormalities in some patients requiring dose reduction. Those are the primary side effects of this drug.
What about the epidemiology of this? What types of people have this kind of lung cancer, and how does it intersect in terms of EGFR mutations?
So the discovery of ALK as an oncogene really occurred only in 2007. So we don't have as much historical data as we do about something like EGFR or KRAS. But several groups around the country have been publishing their experience in screening their panels of patients for ALK. And it looks like it is more common in patients who are never smokers, and a predominance of adenocarcinoma, but not exclusively adenocarcinoma. There are some series that show ALK is more commonly found in males than females, but that's a little unclear. Other groups have not found that. There's also some suggestion that it may be more common in younger patients. But it's very similar overall to the EGFR characteristics.
Now, we know that EGFR mutations have been seen in smokers. What about ALK?
It has been seen in smokers as well. You know, my guess as to why these genes are more common in non-smokers than smokers just has to do with the diluting out of things that cause cancer in the smokers. I think there's probably some sort of basal rate that EGFR mutations and ALK mutations may be found in the population. It may not really be related to smoking or lack thereof, but it's just we have so many patients who have other types of lung cancer caused from the carcinogens in tobacco smoke that among the smokers, someone with an EGFR mutation or an ALK translocation is going to be much more rare than among the never smokers.
Now, it had been said that you didn't see this in a patient who had an EGFR mutation and sort of vice versa. Is that still the case?
Yes, both of these gene mutations function as driver oncogenes, and that's a term that's being more and more commonly used to apply to other cancers as well, like GIST, where they have c-kit driver mutations. Basically, what this implies is that this mutation was really part of the whole origin of the cancer, and that this mutation has changed the biology of the cancer, so it's very dependent upon that signal. And so because the cancer is so dependent upon that signal, you're unlikely to get another driver oncogene in the same cancer. They're really quite distinct, an EGFR mutation lung cancer from a KRAS mutation lung cancer from an ALK.
Now, my take has been, from what I can understand, that there have been clinically meaningful responses to this new agent.
Right. So what was presented at ASCO was an update of the same study, which has been presented, actually was presented at last year's ASCO meeting. It was much smaller at that time and some other international meetings in the intervening year. But basically what happened was there was a phase one study, and this actually occurred primarily at Mass General where I work from some of my colleagues. The study was open. It was a first-in-man, just a typical phase one, all-comers, heavily pretreated patients. And at right around that same time, the ALK mutation was first described in the literature. And because of the history of the whole EGFR story unfolding, the investigators saw very quickly that because this drug blocked ALK, and now here's a newly described mutation in lung cancer that's reliant on ALK, it would behoove them to test the drug early on just to see if there was a signal of activity there. And so they opened a cohort in their phase one first-in-man study to look at the drug in patients with that genetic marker. And right away, they saw a number of really remarkable responses. And so they kept expanding that cohort and opened a bunch of centers internationally. What they presented at ASCO was a response rate in the 60%. I believe it was about 65%. These were actual RECIST criteria responses. Many other patients also had stable disease that was quite durable. So overall, the clinical benefit rate was in the 90% range.
And, you know, you see that, and of course, you want to think about, can you get that for your patients? What about for the physician and community-based practice? What are the situations that they ought to be thinking about maybe getting their patient tested and into a trial, and how do they do it?
Well, that's a great question. I think more and more these genetic tests are moving out of the world of fancy research-based tests and really into the clinic. I think it is, in lung cancer, becoming increasingly important to test the genetics of the cancer, especially if it's an adenocarcinoma. Currently, EGFR genotyping and KRAS genotyping are pretty widely available nationally. Even if not at your hospital, you can do it as a send-out lab. ALK testing is not quite to that level of accessibility yet, but I think it will be soon. There are several academic centers all around the country which are offering the testing, so you could consult a colleague at a regional academic center. I believe that the company that makes the drug is moving as fast as possible towards trying to get this drug FDA approved. And so I think it's very reasonable to expect that within 18 to 24 months, this drug may be on the market. And then I think testing will be much more widely available for all oncologists.
You mentioned KRAS. What do we know about that in lung cancer?
Well, KRAS is one of the most common, probably the most common driver mutation that exists in lung cancer. Unfortunately, it's been one of the hardest nuts to crack as far as figuring out the correct treatment. We know for sure that patients with a KRAS mutation do not do well with EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We suspect that they would not do well with the ALK TKI either. There's conflicting results about chemotherapy in KRAS patients. There certainly are several studies suggesting that they have a lower response rate to chemotherapy than KRAS wild types, but other studies are contradictory to that. So I think it doesn't necessarily mean that a patient won't respond to chemotherapy, but chemotherapy is probably your best bet with a KRAS mutation patient. Now, there are a number of drugs in the pipeline that are being studied in different clinical trials aimed at KRAS mutation, and I hope that one of those will turn out to be a good treatment because this is certainly a large group of patients. One of the other studies that was presented at ASCO this year actually suggested that there may be a signal of preferential benefit in KRAS mutation patients. This was a study that Joan Schiller presented in one of the oral sessions where it was a phase two randomized study, and all of the patients had had previous chemotherapy and never had had an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and they were unselected as far as their molecular characteristics. And they were randomized to either receive erlotinib with a placebo or erlotinib plus this new drug ARQ-197. And ARQ-197 is supposedly a MET inhibitor. That's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor of MET. What they found, which I think people were really buzzing about at ASCO, was that it looked like when they did a multivariate analysis that patients with KRAS mutations might have had one of the bigger benefits when treated with erlotinib plus this MET inhibitor compared to the placebo arm.
Any way to know what would happen if just the MET inhibitor had been given?
Not from this trial, although we do know that erlotinib alone is not very effective for this patient population, so you could make some guesses. So it's difficult to know from this trial. On the surface, there isn't an easily identifiable reason why MET inhibition might affect the KRAS pathway necessarily. But, you know, with a lot of these new drugs, they have multiple off-target effects. And so this was one of the first studies or first large-scale studies done with this agent. I think it was somewhat exciting that there was a signal of activity. We don't yet know if it's 100% due to MET, but it seemed to work for patients, which is really all that matters.
Where do you think things are heading in terms of mutational analysis? I know at Mass General, you all have a so-called rapid targeted analysis. Can you talk a little bit about that? I saw a paper you all published in EMBO Molecular Medicine.
This is the snapshot panel, and several other centers are moving towards this kind of panel as well. So we're certainly not the only ones, although we're quite proud of the work that we've done so far. But basically, because of just this phenomena that there are more and more drugs that are targeting specific driver mutations, and even with new compounds that come out, there seem to be molecular subgroups that do better or worse with the drugs. It's becoming more and more clinically relevant to know this information about your patient when you're making treatment decisions. And so because a lot of these tests are expensive or they take a certain amount of DNA to use, and in lung cancer patients in particular, the biopsy material can be precious because it is somewhat difficult to biopsy lesions in the lung. It makes sense to do a multiplex test or a test that takes a scant amount of DNA and runs a bunch of different tests on the DNA at once. So that's what we've started doing on a clinical basis at Mass General. We test all of our patients with non-small cell lung cancer. We run the same standard panel on them, and we look for known mutations that are common in cancer and can sometimes be targeted by drugs. We look for mutations in EGFR, KRAS, ALK, BRAF. We look for amplification of certain receptors like HER2 or MET and a lot of these common mutations.
How long does it take to get the results back?
So sometimes if their biopsy has been done at another institution, the biggest delay is in getting the material to our pathologist lab. But once the material is in hand, it takes about 10 days for this test.
What were some of the other developments at ASCO that you think are important to know about?
There was a randomized study with a new chemotherapy or a new version of an old chemotherapy, Abraxane, which was somewhat interesting. Mark Sosinski presented this study. This was for first-line chemotherapy patients, and they were treated with a taxane, a Taxol-based regimen, or an Abraxane-based regimen. And as has been seen in breast cancer, there were fewer side effects. The risk of Taxol reaction is so much lower. It's almost next to nothing with Abraxane. So it was much better tolerated. Interestingly, and it's not clear why this was, there was a suggestion that Abraxane may be particularly effective in squamous cell patients, which I think people were excited about because a lot of the advances in lung cancer over the last several years have been really heavily weighted towards adenocarcinoma patients. And so the pile of available therapeutics for squamous cell seems to be getting smaller over time. So the fact that there might be a drug that works better in squamous was exciting for people. So that was interesting.
What was your take overall in terms of efficacy? There's been a lot of debate. You know, started out in breast cancer with some hints that it might be more effective than other taxanes. You know, there's this spark theory and the whole issue of albumin in cancer, which I'm still trying to figure out. Based on the data that was presented at ASCO, did you get any feeling for whether or not there might be more efficacy?
Well, I think it was because of this history with some of their breast cancer results that they actually designed the trial with a primary endpoint of response. And so they did see a higher response in the NAB arm or the Abraxane arm. And so their trial was therefore positive because it met its primary endpoint. I think for a lot of patients with lung cancer, response rate is meaningful, especially if you have patients with a large tumor burden who are symptomatic at the time of progression, then response is something that you really want to achieve. I think for the same reason why there are some patients who you may prefer cisplatin to carboplatin because you really want that response, it's the same kind of a situation.
I guess the difference might be that, you know, rather than being more toxic, theoretically, maybe it would be less toxic. How do you see this playing out in non-protocol therapy? Obviously, the drug's available, though I don't know what would be involved in actually getting it or getting it paid for. But just sort of on a risk-benefit point of view, where do you think it fits in, like right now, if at all, outside of protocol?
I think that especially if you've had a Taxol reaction, it should be one of the first things you reach for. There are upsides and downsides, I think, to the Abraxane. It is, at least in the studies so far, it has been administered weekly. So that could be more inconvenient for patients or for a practice in which infusion time is at a premium. It is a weekly infusion. But I've treated several patients with that drug, granted in the setting of clinical trials, but I've been very impressed with how well people tolerate it. And I think that given this result at ASCO and the fact that the drug is FDA approved, I bet there will be quite a bit of off-label uptake.
What about the issue of the BR19 study? Can you explain what that is and what your thoughts were about that?
Sure. Again, this was one of the things that people were talking about in the hallways because I think no one quite knows what to make of this study. This was a study that was done by the NCI Canada, and it looked at gefitinib or ERISA in the adjuvant setting. So patients with resectable lung cancer. The study, it initially began even before adjuvant chemo was common. So the initial design was that patients would get surgery and then either ERISA or placebo. But once adjuvant chemotherapy began being used commonly, they allowed patients to first get chemo if they would like to and then either get the gefitinib or placebo. Now, in 2005, when there was a lot of activity, shall we say, going on about ERISA, when the FDA narrowed its indication after what was supposed to be the definitive ISIL trial was negative, a lot of ongoing large randomized studies that were using ERISA performed unplanned analyses or stopped their enrollment. And in particular, in this country, the SWOG trial was one of these that stopped prematurely because of the activity going on around the safety and efficacy of gefitinib. So when all of this was going on, the BR19 investigators decided that they would just shut their trial down. So they closed it early before the planned analysis or before the planned accrual, and they actually took everyone off the drug. What they didn't present at the meeting was how many patients were taking drug for what period of time. They presented the month and the year that they shut down the study, and they had patients stop taking drug, but it was hard to tell how many patients had been taking drug and for what period of time. And so this year at ASCO, they presented their results after several years of follow-up so that they had survival data. And what they showed was that the bottom line was there was no difference in survival between patients who received some adjuvant gefitinib versus adjuvant placebo. But what people were concerned about were these trends toward possible harm from the gefitinib. So none of them were statistically significant, but if you looked at the Kaplan-Meier curves, you saw consistently across different groups, including the EGFR mutation positive group, that the gefitinib arm did a little worse than the placebo arm. I think that people weren't entirely sure what to make of it, mainly because it wasn't clear how much drug people got or what might cause that added toxicity. But it does go along with the theme of the SWOG study. So this was an intergroup study done in the United States where patients had inoperable stage 3 lung cancer, and they were treated with definitive chemotherapy radiation using the SWOG regimen, the EP5050 regimen at that time, which included Outback Taxotere. And then patients were randomized to either ERISA or placebo. Again, this study was stopped early because of all of the FDA pullback on gefitinib, and it was at an unplanned analysis time, but there seemed to be a suggestion of harm in the ERISA group. So people are concerned about using an EGFR TKI after early stage therapy, but I think there are still a lot of question marks out there.
Are there situations with an educated patient who has, for example, an EGFR mutation where you would utilize an EGFR TKI or erlotinib adjuvantly?
Well, I think in the setting of a clinical trial, that can be very reasonable. I'm actually chairing a clinical trial that is looking at just that question right now. We're collaborating with 5 or 6 other cancer centers around the country. It's a single-arm trial. There's no placebo. But patients with an EGFR mutation and a fully resected lung cancer have the option of chemotherapy if they like, and then afterwards receive 2 years of erlotinib. And we had a discussion after the presentation of the BR19 data as to whether we should continue with this trial, whether any sort of amendment or modification of the consent form should occur. And all of the investigators agreed that there wasn't really sufficient data to change or to abort the trial for sure. There's another large trial that has been completely accrued. We don't know the results yet, and I think people now will really be looking forward to the results of the RADIANT trial. looking at basically the same thing, except in all comers. They're looking at fully resected lung cancer. Actually, I think you did have to have EGFR immunohistochemistry positivity or FISH positivity to get on, but mutation was not required. And patients were randomized to placebo or erlotinib. So that study, hopefully in about 2 years' time, will really give us an answer. That study was not stopped prematurely for any reason. So, you know, I think if that study is negative, it looks like there's a harm from adjuvant TKIs, then people will really need to rethink. But I think especially interesting to me will be how the patients that have EGFR mutations on that trial do compared to placebo and the experience that we see in our single-arm study.
I know when that SWOG paper came out, people were trying to think about, well, what would the mechanism be for a negative effect? Anything new?
No, I don't think people have a conclusive hypothesis.
My hypothesis was always something to do with numbers and trial variation and, you know, non-biology, but I don't know if that's reasonable or not.
Well, it was after one trial. It becomes a little worrisome after two trials, but I wouldn't count the BR19 study as a fully negative trial. It was stopped prematurely, and so was the SWOG study. So I think that adjuvant therapy right now, evidence-based adjuvant therapy, is chemotherapy. And I hope that targeted therapy has a role or a contribution to helping patients do better, but I don't think outside of the setting of a clinical trial, it's something that should be undertaken currently.
How about the management of patients with the EGFR mutations in the first-line metastatic setting? You mentioned the IPASS data. Where are we today on that question?
I think that from what I've seen in the oncologists I interact with or get referrals from, that data has really been taken up, especially in the last year. And I think the message at ASCO last year was really that this is something that needs to be considered. If you know someone has an EGFR mutation, first-line therapy with a TKI is really becoming the standard of care. We used to see a lot of referrals at Mass General of newly diagnosed patients who might have a mutation, and we would do mutation testing on them. And our referrals of that type of patient has dropped off. And what we're seeing a lot more of now is people who did first-line EGFR TKIs, and now they're becoming resistant, and what should the next step be? So I get the sense that this is really something that is starting to change. There's a lot of discussion at every CME meeting that I've attended in the past year. It's definitely been a topic of question and answer sessions. How does this really affect survival? It doesn't look, although it's a premature look, when they presented the IPASS data, both at ASCO and even in the New England Journal of Medicine publication, the survival analysis wasn't mature. So it looks like there's not going to be a survival benefit. We don't know for sure. But what does that mean for patients if there's no survival benefit? I think what it means for patients is that even if they don't receive it in the first line, they are likely to get a similar benefit by receiving it in the second line. So that is reassuring. But when you have a patient sitting in front of you, as their doctor, you really want to do what's best for them at that moment. And that includes what's most likely to cause a response, what's most likely to help with quality of life. And I think just as impressive as the progression-free survival curves in IPASS were the quality of life data that were presented. And basically, they showed that patients with an EGFR mutation had a much better quality of life when treated with gefitinib compared to chemotherapy, carboplatin and Taxol, to be specific.
I mean, I guess quality of life, maybe anti-tumor response could factor into that. But just, you know, in terms of sort of comparing the risks and toxicities of carboplatin to erlotinib, for example, I would guess most patients would rather take the pill.
Yes, I think erlotinib does have a little bit more toxicity than gefitinib, which is what these studies in Asia were using. And we don't have ready access to gefitinib in this country. But what we do know about patients with EGFR mutations is that they don't seem to need the full 150 milligrams of Tarceva. They respond equally well. So we think to lower doses, especially if they're having toxicity, I have no hesitation about lowering a patient to 100 or even 50 milligrams of erlotinib. In fact, another doctor here from Boston, Dan Costa from Beth Israel Deaconess, his group just published a paper looking at 25 milligrams of erlotinib in patients with EGFR mutations and whether that gave good response. And it did. It was a small group of patients. But I think that focusing on quality of life is important for all of our patients.
What about mechanisms of resistance to EGFR TKIs and also the so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs. I know there's a BIPW2992. What do we know about those agents?
Well, we know that EGFR TKIs work well in patients with an EGFR mutation, but they don't cure the cancer. So just like you're asking, we think most, if not all, patients will develop resistance after an average of 10 to 12 months. More and more centers, such as here in Boston and in New York at Memorial Sloan Kettering and Vanderbilt, have been really making an effort to try and do biopsies on these patients when they become resistant to learn more about the mechanisms of resistance. And now that so many drug companies are running clinical trials with new agents focused on resistance, sometimes these biopsies even help us steer a patient towards a trial that might help them. There's two main mechanisms of resistance that have really been shown to exist in patients to a common degree, which is T790M, which is another mutation in EGFR, which makes it more difficult for a drug like gefitinib or erlotinib to bind to the receptor and inhibit it. That happens in about 50% of people. The other abnormality that's been well documented is MET amplification. So this is a parallel pathway to EGFR that gets turned up or amplified to get around the blocked EGFR signal. And there are several drugs in development that focus on both of these mechanisms of resistance. There's still a large piece of the resistance pie that has a question mark on it. We're not sure exactly what's causing resistance. And that's something a lot of groups are working very hard on in the laboratory. T790M was really the first mechanism of resistance to have a lot of drugs come into clinical trials. So most of these drugs have been, as you mentioned, an irreversible TKI, a second-generation formulation of Tarceva, if you will, that binds irreversibly to the receptor and, at least in laboratory models, overcomes T790M really well. Unfortunately, what we've seen in patients is it does not seem to work as well in patients. And there are a lot of theories about why. One of the leading theories is that the doses of these drugs, you can't give the dose that was given in the preclinical experiments because of other side effects. So, for example, diarrhea or rash limits the dose you can give of the irreversible. So you can't get it up to an effective dose for resistance. Many of these studies have not been published, so, you know, I think the jury is still out to some degree. We just recently published a study about neratinib, which is one of the first irreversible EGFR TKIs. There's a Pfizer irreversible TKI that data has been presented at ASCO a few years ago, but that's not published yet. And this BIBW drug that you mentioned, BIBW2992, is both a HER and an EGFR blocker, and there is a large randomized study that has been completed. The results haven't been reported yet. They looked at patients who had developed resistance to EGFR TKIs, and they randomized them to BIBW versus placebo. So that will be interesting to see the results of that study. It's called Lux Lung 1, but that's not a selected group of patients either. It's all comers who were resistant.
What about in the upfront setting? Are there studies looking at these agents there?
There are, you know, I think the IPASS study, and there have been a couple of other studies now also out of Asia. Dr. Mitsudomi's group had a study that was very similar using gefitinib against chemotherapy in EGFR mutants, and then there was a group led by Dr. Kobayashi that also had a similar study. But in North America, and maybe particularly with the FDA, there is some hesitation to take these studies and generalize them to a North American population or to different EGFR TKIs. And so other groups around the world are looking at first-line therapy in EGFR mutants with some of these other drugs. The Spanish group is looking at erlotinib, and there's an international trial that Boehringer Ingelheim is running with their BIBW2992 drug compared to cisplatin pemetrexed. That's called the Lux Lung 3 study, and that's currently enrolling internationally as well as in the United States. I think it is a very important question that we need to answer for several reasons. One is that, yes, we need to make sure that this same phenomenon holds true in North American patients. We know that there are some differences between Asians and predominantly Caucasians in terms of EGFR TKIs and toxicity and rates of mutation. But I think importantly, too, chemotherapy has evolved and changed in the period since the IPASS study was developed. So the IPASS study looked at carboplatin and Taxol. And now in North America, especially for a patient with adenocarcinoma, pemetrexed has really become a foundation of treatment. So the Lux Lung 3 study does compare BIBW2992 with CIS-PEM, which is probably a more valid modern comparison chemotherapy.
Well, you can also say, what about Bev?
I think that's true. And bevacizumab is not in that study. And so we don't know how a Bev-containing triplet would compare, or we won't know at the end of that study.
What about the use of these newer agents like BIBW2992, not necessarily first-line therapy, but before they've had a TKI?
Well, James Yang presented some data at ASCO about the BIBW2992 compound in TKI-naive patients with EGFR mutations, and the results looked very good. Very high response rate. It was about 60%. Time to progression was a little over a year. So at least as good, potentially a little bit better than Tarceva in these patients. So I think that the second generation EGFR TKIs, similar results, by the way, have been presented with the Pfizer compound as well. I think that these irreversible EGFR TKIs are probably just as good as the first generation when it comes to TKI-naive patients. The real question is, can they do what they were promised, which is combat resistance? Now, there's a very interesting paper this past year that Passiani from Dana-Farber had about a totally different type of EGFR blocker. He worked with a medicinal chemist to come up with a compound that is dissimilar from the other second-generation EGFR TKIs, but it blocks specifically the T790M version of EGFR. And there's a lot of interest and enthusiasm about that compound. It is a few years away from the clinic, though.
You know, I saw your paper on neratinib, and I never thought about it, because we've heard a lot about that in breast cancer. I never thought about it as, quote, irreversible. And does it have a similar sort of spectrum in terms of the targets it hits to, say, BIBW? Is it, you know, I kind of thought it was an anti-HER2 TKI.
Both neratinib and BIBW2992 hit both the HER2 and the EGFR, so I think they have a similar spectrum. The neratinib may have a slightly more proficiency towards the HER2 than BIBW, but I think those drugs that are pan-ERB inhibitors have certainly fared better in the breast cancer treatment world than the lung cancer treatment world, and I don't think anyone fully understands why that is.
Let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 39-year-old person.
Sure. Well, this is a real live case that I had recently that illustrates, I think, what we've been talking about a lot with the targeted therapy. So this is a 39-year-old mother of two who was a never smoker and was in her usual state of excellent health until she began having blurred vision. And she at first thought she wasn't sleeping well enough, or maybe she needed glasses. And she went to an eye doctor who saw, when he did a retinal exam, on one side there seemed to be a mass in the back of her eye, and he thought it looked like a choroidal met of some sort of systemic cancer. So she then went on to have a bunch of scans, and unfortunately she had a lung mass, a primary lung mass, as well as several tiny bilateral lung masses, a bunch of bony mets, and multiple CNS mets. She had a biopsy performed of the lung, which showed adenocarcinoma. And so when I met her, we were trying to figure out how to do genetic testing on her and whether to wait for the testing, start systemic chemotherapy. I think that this is a common question that comes up in the post-IPASS era is, do I wait for the testing? What if someone seems to have a lot of disease? Now, in this patient, she actually had multiple CNS mets, so there was a little bit more flexibility on my end. I thought that the first priority, especially given her visual changes, was that she really needed brain radiation. And so she had brain radiation while we did the EGFR and ALK and KRAS testing. And she came back positive for an EGFR mutation. But in patients who don't need radiation, if they're asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, I often do ask them if they would be willing to wait for the genetic results. If they're not willing to wait or their symptoms don't allow you the luxury of waiting, I think what IPASS has really told us is that you shouldn't guess. You need to test the genotype if you can't or you can't get it quickly enough. Chemotherapy is probably the best treatment for patients in the first-line setting.
And so what happened with this lady?
So she went on to erlotinib, and actually erlotinib in combination with another agent as part of a clinical trial, and she had a great response on her first restaging scans. She had about a 70 or 80% shrinkage, and she's still on treatment. She's about 4 months in at this point, so we'll see how long it lasts. I hope a long time.
How is she tolerating the treatment?
She's tolerating it pretty well. She was fatigued after her whole brain radiation. And so the fatigue stayed with her during the first part of her erlotinib treatment as well. The last visit, she was really noticing that was finally starting to lift. She hasn't had much diarrhea. She has had some rash on her face, for which we've given her some antibiotics.
What do we know about the response in the CNS to EGFR TKIs in patients with mutations?
That's a really good question, because we have a number of patients like this in our clinic where we did the brain radiation while we were doing the genetic testing, and we certainly have a minority of those patients who years later, when they're still alive, have started to have a lot of late neurotoxicity from the radiation. It's made us start to question whether we should be proceeding with whole brain radiation, especially in patients who have a mutation and may have a prolonged survival. Recently, one of our neuro-oncology colleagues, April Eichler, took a look at our experience to see if she could find out anything definitive, and it doesn't look like there is an increase from her analysis that there's an increased incidence of late neurotoxicity problems in patients with an EGFR mutation. But there have been several reports in the literature showing that there can be CNS responses to an oral EGFR TKI. And so if you have that information in hand, you know someone has a mutation, and they have asymptomatic brain mets, I think it's worth a try. Similar to what many people do in small cell lung cancer, when you have a therapy that's highly likely to work and does have some degree of penetration through the blood-brain barrier, you know, as long as there's no mass effect or extreme neurosymptoms, I think it's worth trying to save them the radiation toxicity.
What happened with this lady's vision and her choroidal mets on physical exam?
So they improved quickly. She had a repeat retinal exam from an ophthalmologist, and within the span of a few months, it was barely detectable, and her vision returned to normal.
How about your 55-year-old person?
Sure. I think this is a question that gets talked about a lot at CME meetings as well. Everyone wants to know what everyone else is doing about maintenance therapy. So I recently, just this week, saw a 55-year-old smoker with stage 4 adenocarcinoma who had been treated with carboplatin and Taxol and had had a really good response, a near complete response actually, which is why he went all the way up to 6 cycles. But by the end of 6 cycles, he was definitely feeling fatigued and had some neuropathy, although was still working and wasn't by any means debilitated, but just not feeling himself. And the question is really, what should we do now after 6 cycles? With the recent data, especially the pemetrexed data about maintenance, I think that this is something that people are wondering how to use and when to use. And I think that the jury is still out. So the Cilianu study is a positive study looking at pemetrexed compared to no maintenance therapy and showed a survival benefit, particularly in patients with adenocarcinoma. But the big asterisk next to this study is that many of the patients randomized to placebo or to observation alone, rather, did not go on to receive pemetrexed later. So it's unclear whether this study says that you need to have pemetrexed right after you have your first-line platinum-based chemo, or just that pemetrexed is a very active drug in lung cancer and you should have it at some time. So this is a hotly debated topic. There's also now data that is positive for erlotinib maintenance, although less strikingly so. And my take on it is that it seems to be that patients with a more modest response or really stable disease as their best response to platinum chemotherapy are the ones who benefit the most from maintenance therapy. Patients who already had a striking response to platinum therapy are probably not going to get a lot of further benefit from the maintenance.
So what did you recommend to this patient?
I recommended that we watch him carefully and that he take a break from therapy to recover from his cumulative toxicities.
Looking back at his initial therapy, what do you think you most likely would have treated him with, or what would you treat him with today? Obviously, for some reason, he didn't get Bev. He could have gotten PEM up front also, which I know a lot of people might have done with Carbo.
Yes, he certainly could. And he was, due to cardiac history, was not a great candidate for bevacizumab. And actually, I think he had a PE also at the time of diagnosis. So he could not get bevacizumab. Pemetrexed is certainly I think, increasingly used first-line agent. I think that it is probably overtaking Taxol is my experience from talking to people.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. I mean, the combination of carbo, PEM, and bevacizumab is one that I hear a lot about. What about bevacizumab? Where are you right now in your own practice in terms of utilizing it? And what are some of the research studies out there that you're interested in that regard?
Well, I try to assess every patient for whether or not they can have bevacizumab. And I have to say it is a little frustrating how many patients are ineligible for one reason or another. One thing that I've had several conversations with my colon cancer colleagues about is I feel like in the lung community, we're much more hesitant about some of these relative contraindications than the colon cancer community is. You know, any little bit of hemoptysis and we, run screaming from bevacizumab, which, you know, is probably appropriate because grade 4 or 5 hemoptysis is not something that you want to have happen. I think in other diseases where bleeding from the tumor is not as immediately life-threatening, maybe the uptake has been a little quicker. But I thought one of the interesting things about bevacizumab at ASCO this year was in the plenary session, this was actually an ovarian cancer study, but they looked at this question that in lung cancer we've never really fully looked at. Do you need the maintenance bevacizumab after the combination with chemotherapy? You know, the ECOG 4599 study that really established bevacizumab in lung cancer didn't have that as part of its design. Patients were randomized to either carbotaxol or carbotax-bev with bev maintenance. There was really no aspect of looking at the impact of the bev maintenance. And so in the GOG trial that was presented at ASCO, the gynecologic oncology group trial, they were actually looking at carbotaxol versus carbotaxol-bev with bev maintenance versus carbotaxol-bev without bev maintenance. So they were able to look at that question. And they found that the maintenance was actually a helpful part of the whole equation, which was very interesting for us to see in lung cancer.
Yeah, I actually interviewed Dr. Berger yesterday, believe it or not, and we were talking about this. And I was saying that, you know, because there's an adjuvant breast cancer ECOG study that has similarly, you get the bev either during the chemo or for a year. But I don't think I've seen any randomized study with different sort of durations of bev in any tumor. Have you?
No.
But I was telling him it kind of made me think a little bit about the presentation a year ago in the plenary session by Norman Wallmark of the adjuvant colon study, which was, quote, negative. And yet during the year of the bev, they saw 40% fewer recurrences, which I guess they're still trying to sort out. And the question, you know, do you need longer therapy with this agent? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that in the adjuvant setting, that's a really good question because you would have the luxury of being able to treat patients for a longer period of time. I think in the metastatic lung cancer first-line setting that we tend to treat patients until they progress. At least that's how the ECOG 4599 study did, and the median number of cycles was still 6. But in an adjuvant setting, I think that's very interesting. Now, the lung cancer ECOG adjuvant study is ongoing. It's not fully accrued yet, but that's looking at adjuvant chemo with or without BEV. And I believe they have a year of BEV in that study, similar to the colon cancer study. So, you know, I think it'll be very interesting to see. I hope we don't have similar results in lung cancer.
So how about your 86-year-old woman? I'm always interested in the octogenarians. They're so common in practice.
Yes. So this case I included in our discussion just because I think that there are a lot of emerging technologies out there for palliative measures. And this was one I hadn't heard of until recently when I had an 86-year-old woman who had had a history of stage 2 lung cancer resected a few years ago, who now came in with increasing right hip pain such that she had to go start using a cane and then a walker. And by the time she came to the doctor, she basically couldn't walk anymore. And an MRI of the pelvis and hips showed extensive, likely metastatic disease throughout the femur and the acetabulum. A lot of times, even in elderly patients or patients with a poor prognosis, we recommend, if they have a painful metastases in a weight-bearing bone, to have orthopedic surgery, either to put in some sort of rod or stabilization, because it really is quite palliative for pain control. So I sent her to the orthopedic surgeon to consider that, and he actually suggested instead that she have a interventional radiology procedure with installation of cement. So she had a small pathologic fracture in her acetabulum, which was causing her all this pain, and the interventional radiologist was able to inject some cement in that area to really provide more structural support. She had almost immediate pain relief, and I was quite impressed with this. I think there's a lot of neat technologies out there, both for biopsying patients as well as for palliating their symptoms.
That is fascinating. What about systemic therapy for her?
Well, she actually does not want systemic therapy. She would be a candidate for it. She actually is independently living, and now that her hip pain is better, I think she would be a candidate for systemic therapy, but she doesn't want it. But if she did want it, you know, traditionally we have used single-agent chemotherapy in elderly patients. That's an ASCO recommendation, an NCCN recommendation that you can consider single-agent therapy, especially in elderly patients. There was an interesting presentation at ASCO this year. Actually, it made the plenary session, looking at elderly lung cancer patients getting monotherapy versus platinum-based combo chemotherapy. And the platinum-based combo was basically better. And that was I thought, a really interesting study, because with all the new targeted therapies and genetic tests, I think that how you give chemotherapy to patients has fallen a little bit off the radar, but it shouldn't. I mean, this is the bread and butter of what we see. And I think this study raised a lot of discussion. In fact, the presenter at the podium actually seemed to challenge that ASCO should change its recommendations because there's no longer really randomized evidence. You know, the study by the Italian group, the ELVIS study that promoted single-agent chemotherapy, was comparing to placebo. So compared to placebo, single-agent chemotherapy does well. But compared to a platinum-based doublet, it doesn't look to be nearly as good.
Of course, these patients would have had to be able to receive doublet therapy that might have eliminated some people. If this lady said, okay, give me any kind of chemotherapy you think that would help me, what would you have suggested?
Well, for elderly patients or people actually in general who I don't think are platinum candidates, I have been giving a lot of single-agent pemetrexed if they have adenocarcinoma, and I've been pretty pleased with the results. It's pretty well tolerated. It's easy to give. It's a short infusion. So I like single-agent pemetrexed. I also like single-agent navalbine, although it's more visits and there's more neuropathy.
I didn't see this presentation, but I saw it on the program, and I thought it was really interesting. I know Tom Lynch was one of the authors. I don't know. It might have been at a Mass General. I'm not really sure. But it was like a randomized trial looking at the palliative maneuver in metastatic disease. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So this was a study done by Jennifer Temel, who is one of my colleagues at Mass General. And this was in the oral lung session. A really interesting result. So Dr. Temel's interested in palliative care, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is now a specialty field of medicine that you can actually get fellowship trained in. But we normally, I think oncologists normally call on their palliative care colleagues to help them when someone is near death's door, needs a hospice discussion, needs a code status discussion. Those are the traditional types of consults, or has uncontrollable pain or some other symptom. But palliative care doctors really look at patients from a different angle than oncologists do. And so Dr. Temel hypothesized that maybe getting palliative care involved at the beginning of chemotherapy, at the time of diagnosis, might improve quality of life for metastatic lung cancer patients. And so she designed a randomized prospective clinical trial where patients in our clinic with newly diagnosed stage 4 lung cancer were randomized to either have integrated palliative care, meaning the palliative care doctor saw them at least once a month throughout their course, or standard, which was you could consult palliative care or you didn't have to, whatever the standard regimen would be. So she presented data at ASCO showing that quality of life was indeed much better in the patients who had integrated palliative care. But I think what really caused a buzz at ASCO was that in addition to improved quality of life, these patients had actually improved survival. The Kaplan-Meier curves look very similar to the ECOG 4599 curves. In fact, even though patients in both arms had equal number and types of chemotherapy regimens given, and the palliative care patients had less aggressive care at the end of life than the standard patients, they seemed to survive longer.
And I mean, knowing what these physicians do, since you work with them, what do you think they're doing that made this difference?
Well, I think a couple of things probably factored into the difference. One was much better treatment of depression. We know that lung cancer patients have a very high rate of depression, and that patients with depression can have shorter survival than patients without depression. So I think it dramatically improved the recognition and appropriate treatment of depression. I think that patients also probably had better symptom control. Just with more eyes and ears looking at them, they had their problems recognized and treated more quickly, similar to what we see with patients on other protocols where they have to come in for so many visits. Patients on placebo arms of protocols tend to do a little bit better than patients getting standard care. So that may have been part of it. But in the end, we don't really know. We don't have all the correct data pieces to tease it out. But Dr. Tamil is planning a larger, more definitive study to see if this can be replicated in a multi-center fashion.